This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll be taking a look at the Guantanamo hunger strike.
It's the second hunger strike. The first one in June and July of this year resulted in a promise by the U.S. Department of Defense. They broke that promise, and now we've got between 200 and 500 men starving themselves to death.
We'll also take a look at the confirmation of John Roberts as the nation's 17th Chief Justice of the Supreme Court.
200 years. This guy's the youngest Chief Justice we've ever had. He's going to be around for the next three decades, evidently. And politically, he is the worst on every issue you could think of.
We'll also be talking about the recent FBI assassination of Filiberto Ojeda Rios.
The timing of it was intended to crush the nationalist spirit of the Puerto Rican people. The FBI chose El Grito de Dolores, a holiday marking the Puerto Rican people's uprising against Spanish colonialism. But did it crush the spirit of the Puerto Rican people? Just the opposite.
We'll take a look at the life and work of Constance Baker Motley, one of the first African-American women to attend Columbia Law School and have a seat on the federal bench.
And our own Michael Ratner had one of his first jobs with her, and he's going to reflect on that experience.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild. Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
A few days ago, I got a call from the chambers of Judge Constance Baker Motley, and I normally try to delay answering those calls because generally those calls are trying to have me do a pro bono case for Judge Motley. I clerked for Judge Motley in 1971 and 2, and since then she always tries to throw off, you know, some disastrous case for me. So I said, well, maybe I'll wait a couple days. I'm not really ready to take another case. And then I decided I'd call back. And when I called back, I got the shocking and really sad news that Constance Baker Motley, at over, I think, 84 years old, had just died. I had clerked for her in 1971 and 2, and I actually could have clerked pretty much for whoever I wanted. And in fact, my law school wanted me to clerk for a guy named Judge Kaufman. Judge Kaufman, right. Michael, who was Judge Kaufman for us?
The worst. He was the guy that made sure that the Rosenbergs were electrocuted, among other things. He was considered like the 10th judge on the American Supreme Court because he presided over the most important court underneath the Supreme Court.
Right. By the time I got to him, he was in the Second Circuit, and he was at one point the chief judge and was actually quite liberal and well-known as a liberal judge. But, of course, what we all knew him for, particularly progressives and probably everybody, was his incredible statement when he actually sentenced the Rosenbergs to death and how they'd caused the deaths of millions of people. So I had to say to this sort of cold warrior liberal, Walter Gellhorn, who was the guy who recommended me, that I'm not clerking for Judge Kaufman, and that means I'm probably not going to the Supreme Court as a clerk. The person I want to clerk for, and you know, I was quite radical by that time. It was after 68. I said, is really the most progressive judge in the country, and that was Judge Constance Baker Motley, the first black woman judge on the federal bench. And I think in 1970 or 71 when I was there, still the only black woman federal judge on the bench. And as I look back on her, I really miss her, and I can tell a couple of amazing stories. One was when we had a woman come in on a habeas corpus petition. The woman's name was Afeni Shakur, and Afeni Shakur was in jail at the Brooklyn House of Detention. She was standing trial on the most well-known trial of that day in 1971, too, which was the Black Panther case in New York City. And she was pregnant. And the question was whether she was going to be allowed to see her own doctor or just have the prison doctor see her. She was in Women's House of D, which has now been destroyed. It was in downtown Manhattan, in the Village, actually. Angela Davis had also been in there during the same period. Anyway, Afeni's lawyer come into court. They file a habeas corpus petition. And I'm sitting there, and the other clerk says to me, "Michael, there's no federal right here. We can't do anything here." I said, "What are you talking about here? This is a black woman pregnant in prison. I guarantee you this judge, Gonsons Baker Motley, will grant her the right to see her own doctor." We hold what we would might call a midnight hearing. It took place really 8 or 9 at night. The warden of the prison comes in, who's also African-American, but a tough warden-type person, and says, "Our medical care is fine. We can see her." They bring Afeni Shakur in, and Afeni basically says, "Look, I'm pregnant. I'm 4 or 5 months pregnant, whatever she was, and I want to see a doctor." And Judge Motley, of course, in not even a close case, said, "She's seeing her own doctor. Bring her in." And, of course, the end of the story is, who was she pregnant with but Tupac Shakur, the famous musician who was murdered a few years ago. The other story is how I sort of got my job at the Center, although I wouldn't put it exactly that way, at the Center for Constitutional Rights. I'm sitting in the clerk's office one day, and storming into my office comes Bill Kunstler and Morton Stavis, two of the founders of the Center. And what's happened, it's 1971 or two, the federal government has subpoenaed Arthur Conoy to a grand jury. And they want to ask Arthur the whereabouts of his daughter, Joanne Conoy, because she supposedly knew the whereabouts of some people in the Weather Underground. Arthur first takes the position he's not testifying, that there's such a thing as what's called the parent-child privilege, much like an attorney-client privilege, except it says that the parent shouldn't have to testify about his child. He loses that motion before a judge named Judge Frankel, who actually I was also asked to clerk for but had decided to go for Motley. He loses that before Frankel, and then the next part of the case comes before Judge Motley. And at that point, there was a big question about the type of immunity you could get going before the grand jury. It was, look at the period, 1971-2. It was the beginning of sort of the change in American law. You have to remember, that was the year, which someone pointed out to me, 70, when the first case out of the civil rights movement was lost. Palmer v. Thompson, which was the one where they closed the swimming pool in a state in the South, and rather than admit black people. Bill Kunstler argued that case, and it lost 5-4 in the Supreme Court. And that was sort of the end of the sort of people's movement in the South, and that's why that case lost. In any case, they also, as part of the new package, had decided to limit the immunity you get when you go to the grand jury. So after the new law, you could be prosecuted for the crimes that you testified about, but they just couldn't use the testimony about which you gave evidence. So it comes before before Judge Motley, and no one's tested the law yet. And Kunstler and Stavis say, "Well, the law is unconstitutional. It's what's called use immunity. You need really full immunity, and it's not coextensive with the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination." I work like a dog with Judge Motley for 2 weeks, and of course, she comes out the right way. She holds that the new federal statute giving only what lawyers call use immunity, or only immunizing your testimony, not the crime itself, the transaction, is unconstitutional, and says that Arthur Conoy does not have to testify in front of the grand jury.
All right.
Big victory. But I remember sitting there as this tiny little clerk almost, and seeing these two guys from the Center just storm in. And of course, the government never appealed that case because they didn't have control of the Supreme Court yet. So that immunity remained. A third story I have about Judge Motley is also great. Normally, when you're a clerk for a federal judge, tons of what state prisoners file, what we call writs of habeas corpus, to try and get themselves out of jail. And they just sit on a back shelf behind you as the clerk, and there's stacks of them. And when you get a free moment, you pick one up. So one day I picked one up. A guy can be convicted of either a serious robbery or murder out of a Buffalo state court. And I'm reading along the whole transcript, and I come to the end of the transcript, and I see a summation of the district attorney who says, "And remember, people of the jury, this defendant had hair that was like an animal's hair. It was furry-like hair." So I read that and I say, that's pretty shocking. describing really an African-American man as having hair like an animal's. So I go into Judge Motley's chambers, and I read her just the summation. And she says to me, Michael, we're reversing that case. Just write the opinion. So she was, you know, while she was no radical in the sense of forming the National Lawyers Guild, she was on issues of race, was certainly, and on issues of civil rights, probably one of the most courageous people I'd ever met. And that was my experience clerking. She, of course, before that had spent many years in the South working for Legal Defense Fund under Thurgood Marshall, and had argued the most cases that any woman had ever argued in the Supreme Court at the time I clerked. An extraordinary figure, tough and stubborn is a word, but in a positive way. I mean, she was always insistent. And one of I'll end on this, one of her last positions she always had was that she never understood why African Americans got such incredibly long sentences for anything from robbery to drugs, while white collar criminals and whites, really primarily when I say white collar criminals, got short sentences or no time at all. And she insisted in her courthouse, in her courtroom, of seeing equality in terms of sentencing. So she meted out, and I say meted out, very long sentences for white-collar criminals. And she was always looked at with tremendous disrespect by the circuit court because of that. And normally a circuit court, the appeals court, can't reverse or change a sentence given by the trial court. They have to have some legal excuse for doing it. And in her case, whenever one of these sentences came out for the white-collar criminals, not whenever, but on occasion, the circuit court would find a way to shorten or reverse that sentence and send it back to a different judge for resentencing. So this is Judge Motley is really a great loss, both in a personal way for me and as really an historic figure that played an incredibly significant role in the civil rights movement. Well, just one of the cases she did, she represented James Meredith on his admission to the University of Alabama, wasn't it, I think, in the South. And spent 4 years making sure he got admitted to that school.
Wasn't it Mississippi?
Oh, you're right, Michael. In fact, I saw the hoses on TV when I was in college. It was University of Mississippi.
She used to say that was the greatest moment of her life when he got his degree after 4 years.
James Meredith actually went to Columbia Law School the same years I was there, turns out. And one of the it's anecdotal in a way, but they said that there was one of the classes going on at Columbia, and they were studying some of the race cases that came out of the South. And there was an African-American who'd been accused of murder and was given a life imprisonment by a Southern jury. And the professor asked the class, well, how do you explain how come in a normal case African-Americans accused of murder, particularly of whites, which in this case was, get the death penalty, and in this case the guy got life imprisonment. And Meredith, without even flinching, anecdotal again in the story, raises his hand and says, well, that's because he was innocent. But that's the way it was back then. And unfortunately, as we're seeing as we go forward with Katrina, et cetera, that may still be the way it is today.
There must be some way out of here, said the Joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessmen, they drink my wine, plowmen dig my earth. None of them along the line know what any of it is worth. The thief, he kindly spoke. There are many here among us who feel that life is but a joke. But you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate.
We have Linda Bakil on the show. She's a lawyer in Puerto Rico and in the center of the national struggle there. Linda, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Oh, it's good to have you on. We wanted to know, what's at stake with what we all think from what we're able to read and find out here in New York City, looks like a deliberate political assassination. What's at stake here? What's going on? What's your take on it?
Well, first, I want to sort of give a little bit of background so that your listeners understand. I don't know how much you've already talked, but Filiberto Ojeda Rios was really the symbol of the independent struggle for at least the second half of the 20th century and the last 5 years of this one. He, more than any other single individual, represented the will to defend the dignity of the Puerto Rican nation as an independent, free Latin American entity with its own culture, its own sovereignty, its own reality, and fought to establish the right to this self-determination for the people of Puerto Rico under international law. His political culture was a very profound one. This was not something he, made up after reading a couple of books or just by experience. He really had a very profound political culture and had been active in the struggle to free Puerto Rico since at least the mid-70s. Last Friday afternoon, his house was surrounded by about a little under two dozen, as I understand, FBI agents who, according to the only other person who was there, who was his widow, opened fire on the house. What we know is that the official forensic experts of the Medical Sciences Institute have recovered over 200 military assault-type shells and spent shells and about 18 9-millimeter shells. He had a 9-millimeter pistol. He was wounded, and the bullet pierced his lung. The FBI remained outside of the house until sometime mid to late morning, at least, of the next day. What we all know now is that he was left to bleed to death. We know that the FBI agents knew that he was bleeding to death. I called the FBI and then sent a fax claiming the body on behalf of the family. He said, well, we can't certify that there is a body. And I said, what do you mean? He said, well, we don't have physical custody. I said, well, no one else does. And what you're telling me is that you have the house surrounded. There's a person you know was wounded and is inevitably dead. And you still haven't gone into the house. He said, basically, ma'am, I'm not here to argue with you. But that was, in fact, the case. What does this mean for Puerto Rico besides a long period of national mourning? It's a good question. The hope is that just as the death of David Sanes unified the Puerto Rican people to say no more, the Navy must get out of here, and enabled the people of Puerto Rico to overcome all kinds of ideological, political, class, and other differences to make that united demand for justice and human rights. The hope is that Filiberto's death may have the same effect with regard to the presence and the violence with which the FBI has repressed the independence movement from its inception, that is, the inception of the FBI's presence here in Puerto Rico. Whether that will happen and how long it will take and what form the demands for hands off of Puerto Rico by the FBI and the violent repression will take, I think it's too early to say, but that is certainly the hope of all of those who are still stunned by this really vicious assassination.
Is the Puerto Rican Bar Association involved in this? I mean, are any,
very much so.
It seems to us from New York that assassination, which the government kind of quietly denies as part of their overall political program, is alive and well now. We had John Yoo, who wrote the torture memos, come out with a speech last week endorsing assassination. We had Pat Robertson 2 weeks ago endorsing the idea of killing the president of Venezuela. And now, in fact, we have an actual assassination of one of the great leaders of the Puerto Rican people. What do you think the Puerto Rican Bar Association and other lawyers like yourself say about this with respect to the whole notion of the rule of law?
Well, you know, I think it is emblematic of the lack of respect for the rule of law, and even more important than the rule of law, fundamental human rights on the part of the government of the United States. And I think it's part of a dramatic, frontal, and violent repudiation of the concept of the rule of law and the concept of human rights by the government of the United States.
Reminds me, Linda, so much of Fred Hampton's murder.
Oh, yes.
In Chicago, when they, you know, the Chicago police and the FBI went into his house and just murdered him in his bed.
Right.
First they drugged him, and then they shot him.
The Bar Association, many, many organizations and lawyers are already involved in a number of ways, but they're all at this point about strategy. You know, people are thinking about lawsuits. I've been in conversations with international experts about an independent international inquiry to establish from an impartial and expert point of view the human rights violations and place this assassination in the context of extrajudicial killings.
You know, that's what was done actually in Fred Hampton's case also.
Uh-huh.
And of course, now I think we can complain also to the UN rapporteur.
Yes.
And there's some agencies there.
Correct. There is a lot to do. As I say, this was a real trauma.
Well, I know you were very close to him. At least you had been. You were his lawyer for a long time, right?
Right. And it remained close to his family. So I have to say, I'm one of those who hasn't recovered.
No, I can't imagine, Linda. I remember when I knew you, when you were representing him a number of years ago, and you were, you know, very involved with his case and his litigation, so it must be just a terrible blow.
I hope that you'll call on us at the Center for Constitutional Rights and at the National Lawyers Guild for any kind of support, solidarity work. You have it.
Absolutely. You know, I think we're just beginning to sort of draw up categories of things that need to be done and allies that should be counted on. And I, of course, even in the middle of the confusion and pain, thought, well, this is a case that definitely would interest the center and the guild. And
right, I know. And all I can give you really is a big hug, Linda, and really keep on the fight. I know you've been at it for a long, long time, particularly
Michael,
around Puerto Rico.
It's wonderful to hear your voice and hear those words. It makes me feel very good. It really does. And I think that what all of you are doing is incredibly important, and putting this in the context of the United States' present posture vis-a-vis human rights and the rule of law across the board, both domestically and internationally, is very, very important. And, you know, I know that Filiberto's murder was a couple of stories in the New York Times, but I think it is very, very important that the analysis go on about why this happens and what is at stake for the U.S. in Puerto Rico, and why the people of Puerto Rico have not been able to stand up and demand independence. This is not an isolated example. You know, in 1978, they shot two unarmed university kids. It really entrapped them into an isolated place, murdered them, and then involved the government in massive, massive cover-up. The FBI was involved in the cover-up of the Cerro Maravilla assassinations.
Yeah, I remember when it happened that summer and,
right,
you know, working on it. And then, of course, one of our friends who's now dead, Abby Lugo, was one of the lawyers who helped open that case up.
Absolutely. We have the murder of Angel Rodriguez Cristobal for engaging in civil disobedience to get the Navy out of Vieques in early 90s. So it's a very long tradition. And, you know,
a long tradition of struggle, but then a long tradition of murder by the United States.
Right. And, you know, people in the States say, yeah, but when the Puerto Ricans go to the polls, they don't vote for independence. They vote for everything else. You have to look at the history of repression here and how people understand that, you know, the vote is really the last thing that comes after there have been spaces created for democratic participation and dialogue. And we don't have that yet, not when, you know, they do what they just did with Filiberto. And I think that it was, in part, a very strong message about who's boss here.
I think that's right. Really, thank you. And as I said, from all of us in New York, and I know tomorrow Michael's on the board of the center, and we're going to be at least talking about what help we can give.
Great, and we'll be in touch. Thank you very much.
Thank you
again. Thanks, Linda.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Linda. Solidarity.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That was Linda Bakil, the attorney for the family of Filiberto Ojeda Rios, and one of the leaders in the independence struggle in Puerto Rico, talking to us from San Juan. I'd like to welcome Rafael Cruz to Law and Disorder. I wanted to ask you, what's your take on the Filiberto Ojeda Rios situation?
It seems to be the circumstances indicate that there was a shooting between the FBI and Filiberto. There was information in the news in Puerto Rico that clearly showed that the blood was coming outside of the house. He was wounded next to a door. And you could see clearly the blood from the outside. So they saw that the blood was coming out. Now, today, there was some information in Puerto Rico that they knew by 6:30 or 7 p.m. on the 23rd of September that Filiberto was either dead or had been wounded. Rico. And they conducted a number of other operations that were directed to the presence of the military in Vieques and to the use of Puerto Rico for the invasion of Granada and...
Now, when Filiberto was eventually arrested for the Brinks robbery, is that right?
Okay, this is the Wells Fargo robbery.
Right, the Wells Fargo, and, the one, right.
But in the process of arresting him, and this is really important, they went to Puerto Rico in 1984, and they arrested a number of people. They arrested 15. When they went to arrest Filiberto, there was a gun exchange between him and the FBI. And he injured, they alleged that he injured with a bullet one of the FBI agents, like this time. Filiberto went to trial. Before going to trial for the Wells Fargo robbery, he went to trial for the incident where the FBI agent was injured. Filiberto represented himself, and he was acquitted by a jury in Puerto Rico. At that time, the jury believed his view that he had reason to believe that the FBI was there not to arrest him, but to kill him. Then he's brought to Hartford, Connecticut in 1985, and he's charged with the Wells Fargo robbery. In 1990, he was able to get a $1 million bail, and they put an ankle bracelet on him, an electronic bracelet. During that, between 1985 and 1990, he underwent a number of heart operations. You have to remember that the guy that the FBI killed on September 23rd was 72 years old. He had a pacemaker.
Filiberto was 72 years old, and you know, I still think of him as a young man from that period of the 70s.
And he was limping, and he had a pacemaker. So we're talking about an individual who was, physically speaking, incapable really of too much movement. The interesting thing is that he cut the bracelet on the 23rd of September of 1990.
On El Grito de Lares anniversary.
Right.
Same day that the FBI decided to do this operation, the same day that was the 23rd of September, is the day that Filiberto had cut his bracelet.
Rafael, I just wanted to ask, Filiberto's wife was present when he was assassinated.
Right.
Is she all right? Is she being detained? Or
no, she was freed. She was kept overnight until Saturday. What happened was that when they came into the house, they broke the gate, they started shooting. Then Filiberto yelled at them that someone was there and wanted to come out, and his wife was allowed to come out. They put tape on her face. This was probably like at 4 p.m. and kept her there till like 7 or something like that. She finally went to the house yesterday, and what she found is, you know, the whole thing destroyed. There was in the front door had like 50 bullets, you know, impact, blood all over the place, and the balcony and so forth. They had killed their dog.
Raphael, this is Michael Ratner again, and I really want to thank you for being on the air, but even more for, you know, continuing the struggle around Puerto Rico and trying to get to the bottom of Filiberto's death. Many of us, I know, thought of Filiberto as the Che Guevara of Puerto Rican independence
He was our version of Che Guevara, correct.
Well, thank you again, Raphael.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was Rafael Cruz, attorney and activist in the Puerto Rican independence movement.
Unknown to most Americans, as we speak, there is a hunger strike going on at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, in the prison camp run by the United States. Today, we're pleased to have with us Gita Gutierrez, a lawyer at the Center for Constitutional Rights, who is one of the lawyers representing Guantanamo detainees and has been doing so for a number of years. Welcome, Gita, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
So, Gita, this is a topic, I think, that really is unknown. I mean, the press has just not covered the hunger strike. Can you give the listeners some idea of what's going on in Guantanamo?
The prisoners in Guantanamo have been engaging in a series of hunger strikes. They began, the most recent ones began in June and July of this year, and right now there's a hunger strike going on that started August 8th and is still ongoing. And the prisoners are primarily asking for two things. First, they're asking for a fair hearing in federal court with a lawyer. And they're also asking for the conditions at the camp to be brought into compliance with the Geneva Conventions, very, very basic human rights and human necessities that they're asking for.
Have any of the lawyers been down to see any of the hunger strikers yet?
There have been some lawyers that have gone down and seen men who are striking in the past few months. And most recently, lawyers went down and met with some of the hunger strikers who have been hospitalized, and we learned a great deal from their visit.
I understand they're force-feeding them.
They are. Although, as criticism came out about that practice, the Department of Defense changed it to assisted feeding now is what they're claiming.
Right. That's an interesting euphemism because, of course, for a long time over the years, we've been thinking about the suicides in Guantanamo or the attempted suicides, and they changed that to another euphemism. I don't remember what it was.
Those went from suicide attempts because of depression or to protest what was happening to manipulative, self-injurious behavior, and suddenly there weren't any more suicides.
Right. Suddenly, when you read the figures, no more suicides. But at this point, assisted feeding is really interesting. Talk about what we know about so-called assisted feeding.
We actually know very little at this point. What we do know from attorneys who've met with prisoners who have been hospitalized is that, one, they're in a tremendously bad psychological and physical shape. And they are a number of them who are in the hospital. We think approximately 21 are in the hospital. And out of that group, the Department of Defense has admitted that 20 of them do have feeding tubes inserted. And these tubes are keeping them alive.
I read that or heard from some of the lawyers who are working that because they pulled them out, the people who were on the hunger strike pulled them out, and now what have they done because of that?
Now they actually have nasal tubes in. They have nasal gastric tube that's feeding them, at least for 20 of the prisoners.
Yeah, that's called an NG tube, and they must have their arms shackled, so they can't.
So
pull
they
it
can't
out.
Pull that.
But
out.
I can tell
yep.
you, after
and their heads,
spending
Michael,
time in
the
they
hospital,
have to have their head shackled also, because you could go like you could move your head yeah. back, and they must be chained down completely.
I think what's so disturbing about all of it is these are men who have been committed enough to a hunger strike that they're needing to be force fed or have assisted feeding. They've had no contact whatsoever with their family around these issues right now. They have no religious counselor down there to speak with them or to help them make a decision to perhaps end the fast. And some of them actually are in danger of dying. Yeah.
These are people that want to die. They want to die for a purpose, I think. And I think it's because they've been taken out of the whole realm of human rights. They have no rights. The United States figured out a way to put people in a situation where all they can do is kill themselves.
They have. It is one of the most fundamental forms of protest that political prisoners throughout the world and historically have used. And at this point, the Department of Defense is dealing with it very poorly. They have been unwilling to provide the names of the prisoners who are participating in the hunger strike or who are hospitalized even to the lawyers or to the families of those prisoners. So right now, though, the U.S. press has not given a lot of attention to the hunger strike. It certainly has been reported widely internationally. Families know that men are hospitalized in Guantanamo, but wives, parents don't know if it's their husbands or sons that are in danger of
Gito,
dying.
Let me just back up for 1 second. We're speaking with Gito Gutierrez from the Center for Constitutional Rights on the hunger strikes in Guantanamo. But let me just back up for a second. And in a nutshell, can you tell our listeners what it is that makes Guantanamo so special? Why don't the laws of the world or the United States or the Geneva Accords, why don't they apply there?
Ironically, although the Bush administration selected Guantanamo originally as a no-law zone because only President Bush tried to claim that only U.S. military law applied there, that he was able to choose what laws to apply and what laws to disregard. Ironically, the United States Supreme Court, in a case brought by the Center for Constitutional Rights, Rasul v. Bush, decided in June of 2004 that the men in Guantanamo actually did have a right to a fair hearing in federal court with the assistance of a lawyer. And the men in Guantanamo know that. They know that over a year ago, they should have been entitled to be heard. The Bush administration has defied that mandate at every turn. Both the lawyers and the men in Guantanamo know that although they should have legal rights, this administration is not honoring them. And this is the strongest form of protest they can engage in.
Isn't the government playing down the total number of individuals who are fasting? And do they have a specific definition of what they call a hunger strike in terms of the number of meals denied?
The Department of Defense has been dangerously deceptive about information surrounding the hunger strike. They originally, this series of hunger strikes began in June, and I believe in July, two men from Afghanistan were released from Guantanamo, and they first told reporters that a hunger strike was going on. At that point in July, there were men hospitalized. The hunger strike was approximately 200 prisoners were participating in the hunger strike, and a Department of Defense spokesman, in response to these men's disclosure, said that he was unaware of any strike going on at the base. And at that same time, tours were being given to senators going down to the base, and they had no idea of the hunger strike.
What we call the Potemkin tours, right?
Yes.
Where everything looked rosy and hunky-dory.
Yes, right? And obviously those senators were never shown the hospital or never given the opportunity to speak to the detainees. Most recently, the Department of Defense admitted at the peak that the hunger strike involved 130-something prisoners, and within a matter of days, suddenly only 35 or 36 prisoners were engaging in the hunger strike.
Gita, what do you think is at stake here?
There are two things, I think, that are at stake, and one is the lives of these men and the lives of their families, and the other are bedrock principles of our Constitution and democracy, the idea that the executive can't snatch someone up from any place in the world or any place in this country and throw them into a prison and throw away the key. And access to lawyers and access to their families.
Given what you know about our new Supreme Court Chief Judge Roberts, mm-hmm. how do you think he'd rule on a question like this?
We would hope that he would remember his obligations to uphold the Constitution.
But if we remember what he did in the Hamden case, we're not optimistic, right?
No.
Where we are today with this, what can we do now? I mean, I know the center is running some kind of action site. Can you talk about that a little bit, or what are the plans? Are there plans to do something?
Yeah, one of the things you started off by talking about was how these hunger strikes, not a great deal of attention has been given to them. And one of the most important things is getting the word out that the men are protesting and what's happening to them. At the Center for Constitutional Rights website, there is a Guantanamo Action Center that provides model letters and a campaign for people to help do things like have an independent commission evaluate and assess and investigate what's going on in Guantanamo, asking and requesting legislators to seek more transparency in the information that's coming out of the base. The Department of Defense has just been incredibly deceptive.
Listeners, get your pencils, because Gita's going to give us that website.
It's ccr-ny.org, and there's a very large tab there for the Guantanamo Action Center.
One more time.
ccr-ny.org.
Well, there's one thing about hunger strike that's interesting to me. You know, I represented the Guantanamo detainees in 1991 and 92 when they were HIV-positive refugees, and they also went on a hunger strike. They went on a hunger strike at the point at which Clinton took office and had promised to release them from the camp and refused, and essentially there was nothing more the lawyers could do. We eventually went to trial. But they decided to take their lives into their own hands. They said, we can't cooperate with you anymore. I mean, we can, but it's not going to mean anything. And I remember the huge debates within our legal team over, you know, some people said, you know, it's the worst thing you can do to yourselves. You can't do it. We even brought Jesse Jackson down to Guantanamo to say, begin to eat, don't do this. But in the end, when there's really nothing else, when you've now had a court that is, it's over a year now since we won the case in Rasul. And we have not essentially, I think, to be accurate, we've probably, as a direct result of law, we haven't released any single person from Guantanamo. The pressure of the litigation has released people, but not any single person. So it is similar that when people really are completely at the end of the road, whether it's Bobby Sands or the HIV Haitians or now the people in Guantanamo today.
They are very, very determined to die, to the point where they are, some of the men are accepting meals and flushing them down the toilet so that they never wind up on the DOD's hunger strike list. And attorneys find out when they go down to see the base that some men haven't eaten for 15 days and no one knows. They're very committed to this.
I mean, it is something to see. When I went to Guantanamo and you see people, they were, at that point, the people who weren't in the hospital were laying out in stretchers in the hot sun in the middle of a football field. I mean, they could be together at that point, unlike the current detainees. And then you see them taken off in stretchers with IV in their arms, not moving at all in this brutal sun. It's remarkable to see what people will do, really, to try and not just win their freedom, but win even basic rights.
Well, that's kind of the picture of the United States, isn't it? On the one hand, they're losing New Orleans. On the other hand, they've got people trying to kill themselves. September was a bad month.
So, Gita, I guess our last thing is go to the website, get active, start spreading the word. Let's see if we can get some rights to the people in Guantanamo. Thank you, Gita.
Thank you.
Thanks very much, Gita. We're going to hear now excerpts from a speech on torture by University of Wisconsin professor Al McCoy. Our listeners may remember he wrote the great book on the politics of heroin, tying up the American government, several large corporations, with the heroin trade worldwide. He's now just about to have published a book on American use of torture. He's the guest for the opening of the Harvey Goldberg Classroom at the New York Marxist School Brecht Forum. He's giving a speech. We're going to tune into that speech and listen up. Al McCoy.
In June 2004, the International Red Cross completed a report on what it called systematic torture at Guantanamo. The Red Cross called the use of psychiatrists and psychologists to advise military interrogators on more effective methods, quote, a flagrant violation of medical ethics. The Red Cross concluded in an uncharacteristically blunt language, quote, the construction of such a system cannot be considered other than an intentional system of cruel, unusual, and degrading treatment and a form of torture, end quote. And just last Saturday, you may have missed it, okay? The front page of the New York Times reported allegations by three serving soldiers that the 82nd Airborne Division had, from September 2003 to April 2004, engaged in the systematic torture of Iraqi captives that included, quote, beatings, exposure to extremes of hot and cold, and sleep deprivation. Although the New York Times did not mention it, this abuse coincided with General Sanchez's September 2003 orders allowing these techniques. And where, we might ask, did these ordinary soldiers learn such sophisticated psychological methods? According to the New York Times, quote, the soldiers, while they were serving in Afghanistan, learned the stress techniques from watching Central Intelligence Agency operatives interrogating prisoners, end quote. If you actually go online, and I commend it to your attention, and you read the report, Human Rights Watch, look up that report, you can read the verbatim transcripts by these soldiers, one of whom, the captain, has now identified himself publicly, and they describe this in great detail. Let's reflect about the meaning of this. Let's think a little bit about torture. In the aftermath of the Abu Ghraib scandal, torture has finally emerged from the covert shadows to become the subject of a painful public debate, one in which the lines have been drawn with extraordinary speed and clarity. Even after Abu Ghraib, Harvard Law professor Dershowitz remains the most eloquent voice for legalized court-ordered torture. In his lectures about torture in Israel and America for the past 20 years, audiences, Dershowitz tells us, usually come to the same hard question, but what about the ticking bomb case? In its current variation, the ticking bomb scenario, Dershowitz tells us, quote, involves a captured terrorist who refuses to divulge information about the imminent use of weapons of mass destruction that are capable of killing and injuring thousands of civilians. From this hypothetical situation, Dershowitz moves deftly to a real-world question. If torture is, in fact, being used and or would, in fact, be used in an actual ticking bomb terrorist case, would it be normatively better or worse to have such torture regulated by some kind of warrant? Answering his own question, Dershowitz concludes that torture warrants would reduce the incident of abuse, and he commends it. Or he urges us to adopt it. Now, this position might seem extreme, outrageous, the kind of flamboyant showmanship for which Dershowitz is so justly famous. But in fact, his more sober colleagues have followed along. There has been a surprisingly widespread consideration, advocacy of torture among American academics in the climate of fear that has followed 9/11. Just weeks after the Abu Ghraib scandal broke last year, the Harvard Law School faculty, including Dershowitz, circulated a petition signed by 481 professors of law at 110 leading universities across America calling for serious consideration of, quote, a coercive interrogation policy made within the strict confines of the democratic process. In effect, America's teachers of law, the trainers and formers of the next generation of American lawyers, were asking us all to think seriously about legalizing torture. After 4 years of fighting the war on terror, with this kind of discourse, the time has come for us to interrogate this argument with some very hard questions. Question number one, the question of justification. To begin, we need to confront the key question underlying this debate. Is torture justified in these dangerous times to assure our security? Those who answer yes often harbor fears that Professor Dershowitz captured so cleverly with his fable of the captured terrorist with a ticking bomb in Times Square. When examined closely, this ticking bomb scenario assumes an improbable, even impossible array of variables that runs something like this. First, the FBI or CIA captures a terrorist. Okay, probable. Second, they capture him at the precise moment between the plot's launch and the bomb's burst. Third, the interrogators somehow have sufficiently detailed foreknowledge of his plot to know they must interrogate this person and they must do it right now. But these same agents who know all about this terrorist and his ticking bomb are, for some improbable reason, missing just a few details that only torture can divulge. Such an extraordinary string of coincidences never has and probably never will occur. In the real world, without such fictions or fables, an alleged member of the Al-Qaeda hijacking crew, Zacharias Massawi, sat in a Minneapolis jail cell for nearly a month before 9/11 under desultory investigation as a possible suicide hijacker because the FBI, lacking omniscience, did not have precise foreknowledge of Al-Qaeda's plot or his possible role. In pressing for a search warrant before 9/11, the Bureau's Minneapolis supervisor even warned, quote, he was, quote, trying to keep someone from taking a plane and crashing it into the World Trade Center, end quote. But FBI headquarters in Washington replied there was no evidence that Massawi was a terrorist. Yet another reminder of how difficult it is, in the absence of foreknowledge, to grasp the significance of even such a stunningly, amazingly accurate insight. As Roberta Wallstetter once wrote in her classic study of that other great U.S. intelligence failure, Pearl Harbor, quote, after the event, a signal is always crystal clear. We can now see what disaster it was signaling since the disaster has occurred. But before the event, it is obscure and pregnant with conflicting meanings. Question number two, the question of effectiveness. After 50 years of using torture to fight enemies, communists and terrorists, we now have sufficient evidence to entertain a second hard question. Can torture become an effective weapon in the war on terror? French and American experience, hard won since the 1950s, leads to two clear conclusions. First, torture of the few yields little useful information. But, torture of the many can produce results, although at a prohibitively high political cost. The French army destroyed the urban underground in Algiers with systematic torture of thousands of revolutionary suspects. The CIA's Phoenix program during the Vietnam War no doubt damaged the Viet Cong's communist infrastructure by torture of thousands of South Vietnamese civilians and 41,000 extrajudicial executions. So the choices are clear. Major success from limited surgical torture is a fable, a fiction. But the mass torture of thousands of suspects, some guilty, most innocent, can produce useful intelligence, albeit a high moral and political cost. That leads us then to question three, the question of mass torture. If mass, indiscriminate torture, can in fact yield useful information, then we must confront a third uncomfortable question. Should the United States use mass torture akin to the Phoenix program from Vietnam in Iraq today? In general, there is strong historical evidence that the long-term political cost of mass torture negates the short-term tactical gains. The French army won the Battle of Algiers with torture, but soon lost the war for Algeria in large part because the systematic torture delegitimated the war effort in the eyes of almost all Algerians and many French. As Sir Alastair Horne, author of A Definitive History of This War, concluded, quote, you might say that the Battle of Algiers was won through the use of torture, but that the war, the Algerian War, was lost. There are, in fact, well-established American alternatives to torture. Throughout the war on terror, the FBI has persisted with its proven method of by-the-book interrogations that can withstand critical examination in an open court. In the years before 9/11, the FBI worked on the Kenya-Tanzania embassy bombing cases, using non-coercive interrogation to build rapport with suspects that yielded, by May 2001, accurate intelligence about Al-Qaeda and the conviction of four terrorists who actually pled guilty before U.S. courts. Question number four, why then do we torture? These dismal conclusions lead to a last uncomfortable question. If torture produces such limited gains at such high political cost, why does any rational American leader persist in practices tantamount to torture? If we consider less rational psychological forces to explain torture's commonality, then the answer to this question seems to lie with a prescient CIA observation about Kremlin's leaders applicable to our own White House today. I quote from this CIA study. When feelings of insecurity develop within those holding power in the Kremlin, they become increasingly suspicious and put great pressures on the secret police to obtain arrests and confessions. At such times, police officials are inclined to condone anything which produces a speedy confession, and brutality may become widespread. Even though torture is not, on balance, effective or rational, it persists, I would argue, because of its deep psychological appeal to the powerful and powerless alike in times of crisis. This Abu Ghraib controversy is not, of course, the first American debate over torture in recent memory. From 1970 to 1988, the U.S. Congress tried repeatedly without success to expose elements of this CIA torture procedure in four major congressional investigations. But now, through these photographs from Abu Ghraib, ordinary Americans have seen the interrogation techniques that the CIA has propagated and practiced for nearly half a century. We are now confronted with the burden of choice. The American public can join the international community in repudiating a practice that more than any other represents a denial of democracy.
Professor Al McCoy speaking last Friday at the Brecht Forum New York Marxist School on American use of torture as a policy. He's coming out with a new book on that subject.
Law and Disorder was produced by Jeff Brady. We'd like to thank our affiliates and our many listeners.
We'll all live tomorrow. What I just got saying. I know for sure. I don't want to live today, baby. No sun coming through my window. Feel like I'm living at the bottom of the grave. I wish you all heard me execute me. Why don't be all my miserable? I don't live today. Leave it tomorrow. Just gotta tell you, man. I don't live today. It's a shame to waste your time away like this. Nothing but existing.